Blog Talk Radio.
You're scared, coward. You got mad at the fuck
with me.
I never said nothing to
him. Take out! We are firemen!
What's up, everybody? This is your host, Scott Jarvis, and you are listening to episode 19 of the Loaded Gloves Boxing Podcast. With me today, as always, is my co-host, Victor Atkinson. How are you doing today, man?
I'm all right, man. How about yourself?
Not too bad, actually, for a change. We've got a ton of shit to cover this week, and we'll start with the card that was on Showtime, which was Showtime Presents the PBC. In the main event, we had Jarrett Hurd versus Arislan Delora in a 12-round IBF WBA junior middleweight unification bout. Now, this was a fight, that I wasn't. Well, there was some intrigue for me, but I wasn't too high on it as some other people were, Victor, just because of Arislan Delora. He's been in a lot of shitty fights over the course of his career, especially as of late over the last few years. But I got to tell you, man, even though Jarrett Hurd dropped him late in the 12th round and then won a 12-round split decision, Laura showed me something at least that I didn't know he had before. He was willing to stand in the pocket and trade with her to try to make something happen. And he didn't rely a lot on his legs or his movement, which was, I think, a delight to everybody watching. What did you make of the fight, man?
Laura's legs are gone. There's a reason why he didn't do that. It's because he physically can't. He's 34 years old right now. He's just getting older. That's actually one of the first things to go. It's going to make for some exciting fights now because he can't rely on it. He's going to have to stay in the pocket, but he's getting old.
Sure.
And this is what happens at that stage. I thought that he was going to have enough to just stay away from Hurd and just pot shot him because Hurd is so defensively poor that you can use that strategy and just win fucking 12 rounds straight on his ass. But he can't. I had it a much closer fight than you did. I had it. If it wasn't for the knockdown, I would have had it a draw.
Really?
I heard up by one point, yeah. I mean, this is not that easy of a fight to score, though. A lot of rounds were just pretty close to decided. Just as a preference thing, but as far as, clean, effective punching, I went with Laura for most of the rounds. Not mercenary rounds, but,
Yeah, I know a lot of people did, and I had it just so that the listeners know, in case they didn't see it on my timeline Saturday night. I had it 116 to 112 for Hurd, and I scored the 10th round 10-10, because like you said, Victor, just a moment ago, there was a lot of rounds that could have went either way. Most of those rounds I gave to Hurd because I tend to favor aggression, more than anything else. But I thought Hurd throughout the majority of the fight was the ring general, or was the guy making the fight, but like you said, could have went either way on a lot of those rounds, and Laura came to win. He wasn't there to move out of the way, and like you said, he probably couldn't anymore. But it was a pretty entertaining fight. I don't know that I would put it in my fight of the year candidate category. I didn't mark it down on my spreadsheet that I have for that or for this fight, but I definitely think that it's going to be one of the better fights of the year when the year is, when we're closing things out at the end of December. But that was actually my next question for you, Victor, was how much of Laura's performance do you attribute to his legs just being completely gone and his reflexes being dulled, and how much of that is him coming in and saying, okay, I'm going to stay in the pocket and try to take the puncher's, short game away, because that's Hurd's, main weapon. Those are his big guns. And you think that was mainly due to just Laura being a faded version of himself?
Yeah, if this was Laura's game plan, then Laura is fucking retarded. That would be the absolute worst thing she could possibly do. So,
yeah, it was funny because when I was watching the first couple of rounds, I thought, okay, and we were seeing, a different kind of Arislan Delora in there. I thought, all right, maybe his team knows something that I don't, or that we, the boxing public doesn't. Maybe there's something to this this approach. But then as the round 3, 4, and 5 came around, I started to think, like you just said, I thought, what the fuck is this guy thinking? And then I thought, I can't wait to talk to Victor, because I have a feeling Arislandi Laura not only can no longer move the way he used to and doesn't have the reflexes he once had, but that he and his team knows it. And, you know, they knew that their only shot here was to come in straight at her and try to, you know, to make something happen maybe early, or something dramatic happen at any point in the fight. But, yeah, man, I don't know. I thought, how good did you think the fight was for its entertainment value?
I mean, I wouldn't say fight of the year or anything like that, but it was a solid fight. I enjoyed watching it. I was surprised that that was the fight I liked the most. The other two fights were, man, look, I had to watch the Laura fight today because I fell asleep on that card.
You're not the only one, man. You're not the only one. I was, and we'll go over the other two fights in just a few moments, but going into the main event, you know, I was dozing in and out of sleep throughout the first two fights, especially the second fight, the Truax to Gale fight. But, you know, I get pumped for the main event, and it was a unification bout. So, you know, my wife was like, why don't you go to bed and just watch it in the morning? You know, it's on Showtime, On Demand, whatever. I said, no, I want to watch it. I like to be current. I like to talk with everybody online while everything's going on and whatnot. So I stayed up, and, you know, I kind of got my second win there. But, yeah, man, those first two fights were shit. And heading into this one, I thought, oh, my God, it's an Arislandi Laura fight. And I don't know if Herd's going to be able to catch him or land anything meaningful. And it turned out, like you said, to be a, you know, kind of a big surprise, at least for me, because I thought it'll be an uneventful, you know, 12 round decision for one guy or the other. I wasn't sure, even, you know, leading, you know, as they were doing the fighter announcements, I still wasn't sure who was going to win. But yeah, I don't know, man. Those other two fights were. Oh, Jesus, they were terrible. But getting back to her and Laura, Victor, what did you make of Herd's performance? Because I saw not only a good performance from a capable guy, and we know he's a bit limited in some aspects or in many aspects, but I also saw Herd working on the inside and slipping a lot of punches and doing kind of some subtle things offensively that made me think maybe there's a little bit more to Herd than I originally thought. How do you feel about that?
No, Herd is who we think he is. No, I mean, like, everyone actually does those things at some point in a boxing match. It's not... Okay, a lot of times Laura was catching Herd, which is like a straight left that wasn't even set up. Herd is just not defensively responsible at all. He's not a guy that has good defense. He's just there, and he's big. And he's like his relentless pressure. That's another thing about him. But defensively, he's not good at all. He's really bad, actually.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, I have it here in my notes that I wanted to make sure I point out that he's very hittable. He always seems like he's there to be hit or in position for something to land something big. And Laura got him a few times, but he was the what?
It's cracking up. The microphone's cracking up again. I don't know if that's you or if it's Blog TV though. It sounds like it's so bad with it.
You know what? I've got a new soundboard, and I've got a $500 microphone sitting right in front of my mouth. So it's gotta be either my internet, yeah, or it's gotta be something with Blog Talk. I'll have to talk to them. I usually don't listen to our show after it airs unless there was, you know, something funny or cool or annoying that happened. You know what I mean? So I'll have to go back and listen to that again today. But thanks for the heads up there. Is it sounding a little bit better now?
Right now, yeah, it was doing it like just a couple of seconds ago, but like right this right now, it's not that bad.
We have Charter as our internet provider out here in Southern California, and they're fucking garbage. They're the worst. Like I get 60 down is like their top package. I get 60 down, and I get like 4 or 5 up, and it's always inconsistent. Like I can't even game. I can't even game online properly when my PlayStation 4 is hardwired into my router. So that tells you that there's a problem. I'm working on my desktop here, obviously, which is hardwired into the router as well. But, you know, 4 up is shitty. You know what I mean? To do something like this, I would love to have like 30 or at least 30 or 40 up, but they want to charge me like another $100 or $200 a month for that shit. And I'm not going to do that.
What?
Yeah, it's ridiculous. They're like, oh, you know, you have to go from the residential to the business plan. It's like, motherfucker, are you kidding me? You know what I mean? When I before Charter bought out Time Warner, we had Time Warner here, and I was getting 300 down and 30 up, which is pretty good, you know, by American standards or U.S. standards. It's shit compared to the rest of the majority of the rest of the planet. But you know, I had the good life, you know, when it came to internet connectivity. Then after the buyout, they downgraded everybody that they should have grandfathered in, and you know, now you've got either 100 over 10 or you've got 60 over 5, and both of those are shit. So and they charge us more for the slower packages. So, you know, make of that what you will. I hate Charter and I hate their service and everything about them. So let's jump back into boxing, man. Last couple of bits here on the Herd and Laura fight. We know that Herd is a limited fighter. And like you said, the slipping and some of the little nuances he was doing on the inside are what most competent fighters do. Now, that said, Victor, where do you – I think Herd, you know, given his limitations, I still believe that Jarrett Herd is going to be a problem for anyone at 154.
Most definitely, that size.
Yeah.
I mean, we always say in boxing that a – good big guy can actually end up beating a great little guy, and that's basically what Herd is. He's a huge fucking fighter, so when you're up against that, you have to deal with something like that. And then that pressure that he puts on you, he's gonna break a lot of guys down at 154. He's not gonna have that much success moving up, but for right now, he's gonna have a lot of success.
Do you think Herd has a legitimate shot against Charlo?
Which one, Jamal or Jermell?
154
or 160?
154 for sure. Yeah. No. 160 is. I think Herd would run into some big problems at 160.
Yeah. No, against Jermell, that's a 50-50 fight to me.
Okay.
Mainly because of the size. They were both equal to size. I mean, Jermell isn't a small guy either, but he's not Herd's size. But I feel like the size difference there isn't as big as the difference we saw between Laura and Herd, you know? So I'm picking Jermell, but to me, that's closer to 55-45 in Charlo's favor is how I have it right now.
Okay. I can see that. I know that, and that kind of segues into the next question I was going to ask you. Where do we see Herd going from here? Where would we like him to go from here? I know
that's
that Charlo was calling him out, but it's an easy fight to make because both guys are PBC/Heyman guys, but I'm not so sure. Given Heyman's track record or the PBC's track record, that we're going to get that right away. I think we'll eventually get it, provided both guys continue their winning ways. But I kind of think Herd is going to go. I think they're going to kind of steer clear of Charlo for now, and I think they're going to kind of target the Ollie Smith winner that's going down next month. What do you think about that? Do you think that's a possibility?
That's a possibility, but if I'm the guy that's making the fights, I make Herd versus Charlo as soon as possible, and I use that to propel the winner into like a bigger star.
Okay.
I feel like that's
you
the
don't,
smartest
you,
thing to do.
Well, you don't think unifying further against all the Ollie or Smith, you don't think that would help build that fight? An eventual Charlo fight?
Not really. I don't think anybody's going to care that much about the fight. You know, it's just one of those things where there's so many belts right now that people care more about the fighters than the belts. If that fight is a passion,
right.
I mean, look at fucking Ryan Burnett. He has two belts and nobody really gives that much of a fuck about it. You have to go
through
the fights themselves and not fighting because of the belt, you know, in the stage.
Right. Which is a shame, at least in my opinion, because, you know, belts are important to me. You know, I like to see champions unify and defend, but, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I would be happy if he fought either of those guys, or the potential winner of Ollie and Smith. I just don't know that Heyman would put those two together so quickly. I mean, I agree with you. I'd like to see it happen, but I just don't know that it does. And outside of those two fights, there's always the possibility of a Laura rematch. But outside of that, we've got Austin Trout, which is easy to make, but he's older now. He's on his way out.
I mean, Herd just beat him. Are you talking about?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, Herd just beat him and stopped him.
Yeah. I meant the other guy. Sorry. but we've got,
okay.
And you know who I'm talking about. And we've got let's see, we've got J-Rock, who just fought and won this past Saturday, Brian Castano, and Jack Colke. And then I'm not sure how to pronounce the other name that I have on the list that tie up in the – or that's ranked respectively at junior middleweight. I don't even want to try to pronounce it. Yeah, Sulecki, yeah. I just can't pronounce his first name. Yeah. I don't know that
– after Sulecki fights – Jake, yeah, he's fighting Jacobs. I think after that fight, he's going to stay at 160. So, like, he's actually kind of big for 154. And I've never liked the idea of going back down in weight. Like, even if he's generally fighting 154, he's going to gain to fight Jacobs at 160. And then, since he's already a big guy, I don't think it's going to be good moving back down to 154. So, I think we're going to see more Sulecki at 160.
Okay, yeah, see, I kind of thought the opposite. I thought after Jacobs beats him, depending on the manner in which he beats him, that Sulecki might move back down, but I don't know.
Yeah, well,
I mean,
you have to understand,
if
Jacobs just beats the shit out of Sulecki, even then, Jacobs is a huge guy. Sulecki's not going to lose because he's not built for middleweight. He's going to lose because Jacobs is either better than him or just bigger than him, but none of those are because Jacobs is not a normal 160 pounder. It's not a normal middleweight. He's big as fuck.
No, you're right. Yeah, he's huge. Yeah. Well, that's kind of like Herd. Herd looks like he belongs in with. He can stand next to Sergey Kovalev and look like he, you know what I mean? Like he could be competitive just based on size. What's up?
Yeah. Did you see the fight night weights for them?
No, I did not.
Okay, Showtime is definitely lying about them, or they're doing something wrong. One of the two, because they said that Herd only gained 7 pounds and Lara only gained 6 pounds. So Lara 160, Herd 161. That is definite bullshit. There is no way not possible at all. I'm not buying it.
No, I agree with you, man. I didn't see it, but you know, taking what you've told me at face value, if that's the case. I can definitely see. I mean, networks, you know what I mean? We see it all the time, and we hear it all the time from their, you know, I call them their PR teams, their commentating teams, you know, sitting ringside calling the fight. You know, it's they do anything to protect the house fighter or guys that, you know, are part of a promotional entity that they're contracted to work with, you know what I mean? So I can definitely see something like that going down or had happened, which, yeah, I mean, Herd, I mean, forget Laura for a minute. Herd just looked gigantic. I mean, not just in size, but he looked like a light heavyweight in there. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like if he stepped on a scale, it would have said 171 or 172. You know
exactly.
What I mean?
He sure as shit looked big, 1 pound, or sorry, he sure as shit looked more than 1 pound bigger than Laura, I'll tell you that.
I mean, the size differential, you know, during the entire promotion was more than evident. It was, you know, it was kind of like, whoa, you know? Yeah. I don't know. I think Herd will definitely stay at 154 for the majority of his career, whether he's successful there or not. But I think that, like we've said today and, you know, a couple of weeks back on a show that, as he moves up, he's going to become less and less effective. So, yeah, man, I don't know. Did you have anything else to add to the Herd Laura fight?
Not really. I think we covered pretty much everything I want to talk about for that one. Yeah.
Okay. Now, real quick, I did want to ask, where do you think, what happens to Arislandi Laura if there's no rematch and Herd just moves on?
I mean, he can still beat a lot of guys at 154. I mean, a whole lot of guys. He's still, top five in that division. I've been saying for a while that 154 isn't really that stacked as people made it out to be, but he's still going to be an elite fighter in that division.
Okay. Yeah, I tend to agree with that.
He's going to have more exciting fights now because his legs, he's not good enough to just move away the way he wants to anymore. So,
right. No, that makes it much more interesting. Yep. All right. Well, then with that, we'll just move on to the next fight down on the list. And by down, I mean shitty. we had the penultimate fight on Showtime this past Saturday was Caleb Truax versus James DeGale, which was a rematch, and it was a 12-rounder for Truax's IBF super middleweight title, and in that, James DeGale walks away with a unanimous decision over Truax, but I thought, Victor, that James DeGale looked extremely unimpressive and very flat against a guy who's known to be pretty much a middle-of-the-road journeyman. And this is the second fight in a row against the same opponent where the Gales just kind of look like crap. What did you make of the fight and the Gales performance more specifically?
I don't think Truex is considered a journeyman. I think it's a step above that. Beating him means that you're at least title contender status, but DeGale has not really looked impressive at all since the Jack fight. And you can even say before then, he was having tough fights with guys that on paper he should not be having tough fights with. That's just who DeGale has been for a while.
Right.
I consider him to be like the least impressive Olympic gold medalist I've ever seen.
Yeah, that's not an unfair, what do I want to call that? My vocabulary is lacking today because I'm starving. I apologize to you and everybody listening. I don't think that's unfair to you know, call him that or to say that about him. I thought, he was really flat. And, I mean, the fight was full of holding and headbutts. And I know DeGale was docked a point later in the fight for some of that shit.
He got a point taken away because of the shoulder, if I recall correctly.
Yeah. Like he was pushing off of the shoulder. Yeah. But there was so many head collisions I think the ref ruled that really bad headbutt or that cut that DeGale got is ruled as being from a punch, which was clearly not the case, especially after you saw the replay. Yeah, I just thought, what the fuck? But this fight, Victor, the second or third round, that was when my wife came in and found me kind of like, I don't want to say slumped over like I had a heart attack, but like, I was kind of nodding off and my head was over to the side and down. And she's tapped me on the shoulder, hitting me, going, hey, wake up and go to bed. Wake up and go to bed. Watch this tomorrow. And I thought, no, I want to get the shit out of the way because it was bad enough to put me to sleep, after a long day of, exercise at the gym and whatnot and playing with my kids. It was like, I really had to fight to stay awake. And, I went back and watched highlights too, because I know I missed, 10 seconds here, 30 seconds there, but God, what a dreadful fight, man. And then to make it worse, before the fight, backstage, I think Jim Gray, was interviewing James DeGale, and, DeGale said, he would retire if he lost to Truax again because he believed he was on, a level or two above Truax. And then after the fight, Victor, James DeGale was quoted as saying, "I told you when I'm fit and injury free, people will find it hard to beat me. I showed some heart this time. In the first fight, I wasn't fit. I was like a little kid." I wouldn't, given the nature of that fight and how he won, or the manner in which he won and how unimpressive he looked against Truax, I don't know how you can really count. I mean, it's a victory, but I wouldn't, it's not something I'd go out and celebrate. You know what I mean?
He did not look like a guy that was a level above his opponent that night.
Yeah, it looked like an evenly matched. Yeah, there was a...
I remember the 117, 110, that guy.
Yeah. There was some weird scoring going on all night, or I thought at least. But in this fight and the fight preceding it, the scores were definitely fucked up. The 117, 110, speaking metaphorically, I don't know how the fuck that happened. I mean, what was that guy watching? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
What's your take on that? Do you think the fix was in, as they say, or it was just, bald incompetence?
Yeah, the fix, definitely. Because if you think about it, this was like a Mayweather promotions fight, or like he was the co-promoter or something like that. I forget exactly what his hand in it was, but he was involved in some capacity to it. And Mayweather seemed like he was trying to get DeGale on his team at one point, so it's interesting that DeGale's the guy that gets that huge push with the scorecards, considering that Mayweather was involved in this, or that Mayweather wanted him on his team, basically. So
that's not an unsound. My vocabulary is off again. That's not definitely not an unsound thing to say. I wondered the same myself to some degree. And given the fact that we had Adelaide Bird on the judging the fight before this, You know what I mean? It just, it's a bad look all around when I see scores like that, and you know, certain judges or referees working certain fights or at certain locations. But yeah, she scored. Let me go down. Just to digress for a moment. Oh no! You know what? She worked the Angulo Mora fight and had a really fucked up scorecard. I apologize. I'm way off my game today. It's just because I haven't eaten since like 8 o'clock this morning. And I'm hypoglycemic, so it fucks me up. But anyways, yeah, I know better, but I'm a big boy. I have to, you know, play with the big boys, pay with the big boys kind of thing. It's my fault. But anyway, getting back to the fight or to the judging, the questionable judging, in the fight preceding this, the Williams-Gallimore fight, which we'll get to in a few moments, Patricia Morse-Jarman scored it a draw, 114-114, which I think most of us kind of looked at and said, what the fuck? You know what I mean? Because Williams was clearly the winner in that one. But jumping back to the DeGale-Truax bout, yeah, that 117-110 victor, I don't understand that at all. DeGale was the winner for me. I didn't have any doubt about that, but 117-110 is an atrocious scorecard. Now, to kind of put DeGale under the microscope for a few minutes here, Victor, we know he turned in a really unimpressive performance, but where do you see DeGale going from here, and how much of a threat is he at 168 to, you know, guys like Groves and Smith, you know, and even Benavidez, you know what I mean?
I think the smartest thing for him to do is to fight Groves at super middleweight in the UK and use that as his retirement fight. And yeah, Groves is definitely going to beat him. If you want the most money, that is the ideal matchup for him. Or I guess use DeGale as like a benchmark for other fighters or something like that. Have him fight my boy Benavidez and have Benavidez beat him. But I don't see DeGale beating anybody at the top tier at 168 right now. I just think he's done, man.
You don't think he could beat Callum Smith?
I mean, we'll see how Callum Smith looks in these finals, but if
finals, yeah.
If Smith is able to win that, then no, I don't think DeGale is going to beat him.
Yeah, I don't. I kind of looked at Jimmy DeGale, you know, after the fight, and I thought, man, you know, this. What else is there for this guy to do? I mean, he was never really the elite, you know, or great fighter that he was sold to us as. He was just kind of an okay, you know, very good or good fighter. He never really reached that pinnacle that so many thought he might. Given that,
DeGale was just weird though. Like, he was a guy that in his matches he would show that he was pretty fucking good or like great even, but then in those same matches he would have moments where it was tougher than it should have been. It's basically
right.
Like the Norris thing that I talk about, where he's great, but he'll make a lot of fights harder than they should be. Only DeGale would always do this. Linares doesn't do that all the time. DeGale did do that pretty much all of the time.
Right. Yeah, I agree. And I saw the same things you did in him throughout his career up to this point. I kind of hope, you know, I don't want to see any fighter take permanent damage or, you know, have a horrible life after they leave the sport. So I hope, you know, like you said, I hope there's something, some kind of big cash out for DeGale, you know what I mean? Whether they use him as a measuring stick or a gatekeeper, or, you know, he gets a big, you know, another fight with Groves at some point, hopefully soon down the line, because I think DeGale's 32 now, and it's, you know, like my eye doctor always tells me when I complain about my, you know, my prescription or my eyes getting worse every year I see him, he's like, well, you know, it's not going to get any better from here. You're just going to continue to decline. So, you know, it's not like he's, you know, if he's in his prime, which I don't think he is, his physical prime, he's definitely at the very tail end of it there. So, you know, there's nowhere to go but down, in my opinion, for James DeGale. So with that said, let's just move on to the J-Rock versus Nathaniel Gilmore fight. That was a 12-rounder for the IBF Junior Middleweight Eliminator. And the winner of that became... I'm skipping around here. Sorry about that. J-Rock actually won that fight in the first of his biannual appearances. And that fight, Victor, was absolutely dreadful. And Williams won a majority decision in that, by the way. And again, the scores were 116-112, 117-110, and that was a Max DeLuca scorecard. And then Patricia Moore's Jarman turned into 114-114 draw, which really makes me scratch my head. Now, I don't want to spend too much time on this fight, Victor, because it was absolutely awful. This one was – I wasn't falling asleep yet at this point, but it was – I remember there were several more moments throughout the fight where I thought, man, do I really need to watch this right now? Is there anything else I could or should be doing? What did you make of the performance, especially – or the fight and you know, specifically looking at J-Rock's performance?
I'm actually not mad at the draw scorecard. I mean, when you have a fight where the referee has to get involved like every 10 seconds, you don't really have a whole lot to go by in the rounds. And okay. At that point, I don't really care what you do. I'm not going to fault you as a scorer for doing anything at that point. Just go ahead and write down whatever. You don't have a whole lot of data to go by. But
right.
For this fight, I didn't like it. It's kind of hard for me to even say how good J-Rock is. To me, J-Rock hasn't really been the same since his match against Charlo. He did show me that he can at least take a punch, though, because Gallimore has a whole lot of power, and J-Rock did get cracked a couple of times, but he didn't go down or even look like he was about to.
Right.
So that's a plus for him, but J-Rock just hasn't looked the same to me since that fight. He hasn't looked the same as Ishae Smith fight. He didn't look the same in the Conley fight. J-Rock is a guy that at 154 had lost maybe like in all his opponents lost maybe 3 rounds.
Right.
And then he fought Charlo and the rounds where he didn't get knocked down, he was winning, but he did get knocked down by a jab and then stopped later on. And it hasn't been the same since then to me.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's just me, like the expectations of him were gone down or like too high or something, but to me, he has not looked the same.
Well, just to kind of put things in perspective, as it pertains to Julian J-Rock Williams, Victor, there was a point in time, and it wasn't too long ago, just 2 or 3 years back, where everyone was real high on the guy when he was coming up, and I remember reading a ton of comments on Twitter and on Facebook, and even talking to some people on the phone where they thought, man, when this guy matures and he moves up to 160, he's going to be the guy to give Golovkin problems or even beat him. And I just thought,
don't even understand what makes Golovkin good in the first place. They don't know anything about boxing techniques. So,
it was so early in J-Rock's career. I thought, well, how are you able to ascertain that? You know, based on the fights he's had so far against, you know, questionable opposition at times. You know, it's just like, you know, I don't know. But to kind of bring it forward a little bit here. I agree with you 100%. It's not just you, Victor. Ever since the Charlo fight, J-Rock has, to me at least, he's looked gun-shy at times. He doesn't seem as effective. It doesn't look like he moves as well or as sharply as he once did. You tell me, because you've actually boxed, if you suffer a big knockout defeat like that, especially one that you're not expecting to lose in that manner, can that not only make you gun shy, but can that make you like kind of take your head out of the game and make you so fearful or afraid that you kind of shut down or perform at like half speed, so to speak?
Yeah, it's a psychological thing. It's not like neurological because he didn't take sustained beating. If he got back in the ring like a fucking week later, which obviously wouldn't happen, then you would be looking at neurological damage where his reflexes are complete shit and things like that. But that's not going to happen in this modern era of boxing, so it's all psychological. But yeah, you're thinking like, oh, I could get caught again, or like, oh,
right,
I could get hurt again like that, and you just end up slowing down, can't pull the trigger, can't take advantage of like certain openings that you see in front of you. That's a pretty normal thing.
So would it be fair of me to say, or anyone to say, that in like a scenario that J-Rock found himself in against Charlo a couple of years ago, that kind of takes their head out of the game, or they're thinking too much in there about the wrong things rather than fighting or reacting?
Maybe. Yeah.
Maybe.
Oh, and also, it is a good thing what they're doing, though. They're basically in the rehabilitation stage for J-Rock, and putting him up against a guy that has a lot of power is pretty good because it should help build his confidence back up. I remember at one time we had a show and like you asked me, is it important to even like have these fights like this after a guy gets knocked out? And it is very important. And this, if we see Jarek improve after this, then that will be why, is to build the guy's confidence back up and not have him be gun shy, you know?
Right. Now, can that, I got to ask you too, because you're, I think you're the only boxer that I've ever known, or like on a personal level. Can a guy like J-Rock or anybody that's been, you know, suffered that psychological, like the psychological effects of a knockout, can that be eroded by these tune-up bouts, or they get their confidence back and they take one heavy shot? Can that, like, that fear come rushing back into a fighter's mind where all of a sudden they'll clam up and stop throwing?
It could, but again, it's all about your confidence. If you accept it as something, because like anybody can be knocked out. You have to like get it in your head that that could happen to anyone, and that you are who you were before that knockout even happened. Like once you have that in your mind, then you should be all right. Once you get back in the habit of like, oh, it could happen again. I mean, granted, it could happen again, but once you get in your mind that it's going to happen again, then you've already lost. Confidence is very important, and these fights help build up your confidence. And we may see J-Rock go back to who he was before. We may not. We don't know. That's why we fight the fights. I'm just going to see where he goes from here, though.
Yeah, that's actually my next question for you. Given the kind of tepid nature of the last few fights he's had, where do you think he's going to go next? And you know, how do you think he fares? I mean, he became the mandatory, I think, for Jared Herd. So if Herd came straight at Williams, I mean, is Team Williams going to take that fight, or is are they going to go like you just did? You know, we want to go over here. You know what I mean? We want to stay away from one Jared Herd for another year or two. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you leave that monster alone. You don't want to go anywhere near that right now. And that is, it's not just because, like, J-Rock's the better boxer here, but Herd is too goddamn big, too big, too fucking relentless. That is not the move you want to make right now. Fight Trout,
and especially if Williams hasn't recovered psychologically, and I'm sure he's familiar with what Herd's done, you know what I mean? And of the fighter himself. So, I could definitely see him going for, you know, somebody of that maybe doesn't hit as hard or isn't quite as big, you know what I mean, or physically intimidating as Herd. But where did you say you wanted to see him go?
Austin Trout.
When you first said that, I thought, no, Trout's kind of washed. He's older now. He's kind of like in the same boat as Laura, you know what I mean, where those, they relied a lot on their reflexes and their legs and feet to get him, you know, to win. But given the obvious state of J-Rock's psyche, that actually isn't, I don't think, is a bad matchup. Now, do you think that happens? Do you think that's likely?
I don't know. I can't predict what those guys do at all. They don't make sense to me. Like, they have so many tools to make good fights, and they just don't. They're kind of getting away from it right now, I think, because, like, the Laura Hurd fight, that made sense. It was a good unification fight. They've done a couple of other things recently that are not terrible decisions, but still, that's not enough for me to go out and say, all right, they're going to do the right thing here and put the right guy against the other right guy. But I don't know.
It's too bad we can't get a World Boxing Super Series 154 tournament. Like, I think it's prime for that right now. But
really, I wouldn't even say that right now. If 154, we really just have Herd and Charlo and what? What else are the big fights there?
Herd, Charlo. Well, I say that just from the viewpoint or from the aspect that a lot of these guys may want to avoid each other or may end up avoiding each other for a long time, and I don't want to see that happen. Tournaments, you know, put guys in there and make them fight.
I get what you're saying. It's just two guys. It's not, like, tournament-worthy to me.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of, I look at heavyweight the same way. I would still like to see a tournament there, even though only two guys really matter in that division. I get what you're saying. You know, that's valid. I don't know where they take J-Rock next. I definitely don't think they steer him towards Herd or even Charlo. Maybe Trout, but... Yeah, outside of Trout, I don't know, man. I guess we just have to wait and see.
I will say this about J-Rock, though. I've always liked watching him work, and I do want to see him do well.
Yeah, you know, I think he's a fine boxer. I mean, I don't think he's... ever going to be, you know, on that elite, elite marquee level, but he's definitely somebody that you know, is worth watching when he's not turning in the performances that he has lately. Hopefully he can, you know, get past that knockout, because it's still clearly haunting him. Because like you said, he didn't take the, you know, at least not that we know of, he didn't sustain any neurological damage from the Charlo knockout. So, oh man, perfect timing. I've got the hiccups. Before we move on, Victor, to news and notes, I want to remind our callers that they are our listeners, excuse me, that they can call in and talk to us about anything boxing related. That number to use is 657-383-0391. You can also tweet your questions at me at SplitDBoxing or at Victor at 757-VIC at any time, and we'll read those on the air. So let's move on to news and notes. In the first bit of news, Michael Montero actually interviewed Murat Gassayev and Abel Sanchez at the summit, and confirmed that win or lose, Murat Gassayev will be moving up to heavyweight after the World Boxing Super Series final against Oleksandr Usyk. Now, I wanted to ask you, Victor, because I know you're kind of a fan of Gassayev, too, and he's pretty impressive. How do you think he fares at heavyweight? Do you think he's as successful?
Well, this is actually old news. They've been saying that for a while, that both Usyk and Gassayev after the tournament are going to move up to heavyweight. We've known this since the tournament started, I think.
Oh, I knew that. I think we knew that Usyk was definitely going to move up, but and there was rumors of Gassayev possibly moving up, but... it was confirmed in that interview. That was the first confirmation I'd actually seen.
They've been saying this for a minute.
Really? See, I had never seen that come out of Gassayev's mouth until I watched that video. So that was pretty interesting. But what do you think? I think we've talked about Usyk's effectiveness at heavyweight a couple of times. But how do you think Gassayev does up there?
I don't know. I mean, like at this. The heavyweight division right now is really fucking weird. I go two ways with it because these guys are big. Joshua Wilder, they're big, tall guys.
Yes.
But at the same time, their technique isn't great. So I always go back to thinking like, all right, so I'm a big guy on technique. If you don't have good technique, I'm not even going to consider you a good boxer. And I'm always going to think that you're going to lose when you're up against a better technician than you. So
sure. From
that perspective, then guys like Usyk or Gassayev, especially Usyk, are going to do very well at heavyweight because they're technically sound enough to be able to get past that size disadvantage. Then on the other hand, weight classes exist for a matter. Size definitely matters. So will they be able to climb that mountain, get over that hump and beat these guys? I don't know. Gassayev, I feel like the way he boxes, I think he'd have less of sex. Wow, success. Good job. More, less success.
Hey, now.
Yeah. Because, like, a lot of his defense relies on that high guard that is pretty, like, impenetrable pretty much. But if you're up against the bigger, stronger guy, you can't do that the same way because they're going to break through that guard. So,
yeah.
I don't know.
They're definitely moving up. Yeah. Oh no, yeah, for sure. I'm kind of with you on that. I was giving it some thought. You know, I wrote that bit of news down earlier or late last week, and I didn't get to cover it on last week's show. I think that Gassayev probably has some success against the smaller heavyweights. It's so hard. Like you said, a good big man beats a great little man in most cases.
Mm-hmm.
And that's usually the true, you know, that usually rings true with a few notable exceptions. But I can't see Gassayev. I mean, I obviously against Joshua, I would pick Joshua just because Joshua is this like hulking mass coming at you. You know what I mean? With all kinds of power in both hands.
That jab too.
Yeah, exactly. Against Wilder, I think Wilder is too lanky and long and maybe not. Oh. Maybe Gassayev might be the stronger guy, like physically, but
I actually like his chances against Wilder because all the Wilders
sure.
are a whole lot bigger, longer. Wilder doesn't use his reach correctly, and he also makes so many mistakes that I'm pretty sure Gassiev could punish. I like his chances against Wilder more than I like his chances against Joshua.
Oh, of course, of course. Me too. Now, do you see in a hypothetical Gassiev-Wilder matchup, do you see Gassiev making Wilder pay when he misses and launching one of those gnarly uppercuts he has?
Definitely.
Yeah, it's kind of how I see it too. The size would always bother me going into that match, but I think Gassiev has a lot of talent and is fundamentally much more sound than Deontay Wilder. But yeah, man, I it's something I gave a lot of thought about over the weekend.
I'll tell you this though, depending on how Povetkin does against Joshua, that will tell me a lot about how I see the Gassiev Joshua hypothetical matchup going. I know they don't fight the same, but it will tell me, it'll help me paint a better picture of it in my mind.
Right. Now, it's all hypothetical right now. I just wanted to talk about it a bit and get your thoughts, because it's an interesting thing, because both Gassiev and Usyk, regardless of whether they win or lose the final next month, both guys are extremely talented and they're exciting to watch, to different degrees. But it's always interesting, because not every cruiserweight that moves up has success, even the really good ones. Evander Holyfield being the prime example of somebody who did have a lot of success.
And he didn't do it against guys this large, if you think about it. This is a pretty uncharted territory.
Right. And then I think of like Roy Jones Jr., you know, in his prime moving up and taking on John Ruiz. You know, I mean, Ruiz was seen as the weakest title holder at the time, you know, so it was smart for Jones and his team to target him. But, you know, I mean, even Jones, he's a big guy, especially everybody's big compared to me, but I don't think even somebody with the skill and the talent that Jones had back in the day would have a lot of success against, you know, like the quote unquote super heavyweights of the modern era. It's just, those guys are so huge, man. You know what I mean? And even somebody with power, I wonder, somebody with the power of like Mike Tyson or Ernie Shavers, who hit like a motherfucker, you know, when you're 230 and you're punching a guy that's 250, 270, you know, and 6'6" or 6'7", it's like how much of that power, you know, from cruiserweight comes up to heavyweight. You know what I mean?
Nah, actually, the human body is basically like a glass cannon. Like, anybody can be knocked out. Like, once you go above, once you hit like light heavyweight and above, everyone has power. Like, you can definitely knock those guys out. That's not a factor there at all.
So could Golovkin conceivably get in the ring with like Anthony Joshua and land one lucky shot and drop him? Is that possible?
If it was the type of thing where we're looking strictly at power, if we're looking at like as hard as Golovkin hits, could Golovkin knock out Anthony Joshua? If like Joshua were to let Golovkin get off a free shot, then yeah, Golovkin probably could do that. Like anyone could.
Right. Well, I've seen that in MMA where those gigantic guys, I always think of Bob Sapp, you know, the guy's like 7 feet tall and he's 500 pounds of muscle. And then this little guy gets in there and you know, drops a kick to the chin or a punch to the side of the head and they're out, you know, or they drop. Mm-hmm. So, and I've seen that in street fights too, you know, in both in real life and on YouTube. So yeah, I guess that makes sense. And I guess we'll have to wait and see, because I think even after the final next month, even if they fight, you know, in late summer or in early fall, whenever both of those guys make their move up, it's not going to be against, you know, anybody with a marquee name. You know, it's not going to be a Joshua or a Wilder, or probably even somebody on Povetkin's level. I think they'll take their time and try to do it right, and they'll be cautious, but we'll just have to wait and see. Now, the next bit of news, Victor, was something I was really looking...
Before you go on, I think for Usyk, I think you could fast-track him to it. For Gassiev, I'd let him get a little bit more experience, because Usyk, because it was an Olympic gold medal, he was doing like bigger guys at some point. We have seen him against like huge guys before. We haven't really seen that with Gassiev. So for Usyk, I think, all right, you've done this before. Maybe it hasn't been in a while, but you have done this. We can at least put you up against like a big baby Miller for your first fight. For Gassiev, though, I want him to fight somebody just on a lower tier than that.
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely sound advice, and it'll probably be how it plays out too. Yeah, man. I guess we just have to wait and see again, because, you know, if fall or late summer at the earliest, which is still a ways away. But moving on, Victor, I wanted to talk about kind of this clusterfuck that Canelo has created quote unquote allegedly using performance enhancing substances and then dropping out of the Cinco de Mayo fight or rematch against Golovkin. I know Golovkin's on the hunt for his next quote unquote victim, and it will be a victim because it's not going to be anybody of anybody on Canelo's level or even on close to Golovkin's level, because I think they're going to play it safe and keep the rematch in September, a guarantee. But they were looking at a kid, Victor, named Jamie Munguia. I'm not sure how to pronounce his last name. This kid comes out of Mexico. He's 21 years old. He's a junior middleweight. He hasn't had a fight at middleweight yet from what I could find. And he was the front runner for a day or two, I think, maybe a little bit more. And thankfully, I'm so happy the Nevada Athletic State Commission, regardless of the reason they rejected him, ended up rejecting him as an opponent and they wouldn't approve him. How did you feel about that when you read that he was the front runner to replace Canelo?
Very, very strange, and it's out of character for Golovkin to win a match like this. So I'm thinking that there are things going on that we don't fully understand. Because, like I said, this is just out of character for Golovkin to want to fight a, 21-year-old prospect from a lower division. That has never, ever happened before with him. He's always trying to go at the top of the list and, go down from there. Because, all right, number one guy won't fight me. Number two guy, all right, you won't fight me either. All right, number three guy, okay, shit, you won't fight me either. Number four. Like, that's his training.
Right.
That's the line of thought that he has. Like, going to another division and picking a guy that's not even the fucking top five, short notice, I don't understand what this is.
Well, I was upset primarily with it when Dan Raphael broke the news, or at least his reporting was the first that I saw. And I thought, I immediately went to BoxRec because I was eating lunch. So I popped up BoxRec on my phone and I looked Jamie up and I saw 154 and I could totally tell he was just a prospect. And I thought, 21 years old. My first thought was, there's a serious risk of this kid's career ending before it even begins. I mean, even in decline, and the last thing to go is a fighter's punch. We all know that. But even in decline, Golovkin is, dangerous. He's a fearsome opponent for anybody, even somebody young and strong.
It's not even just the power. Yeah. If you're 21 years old, you're very inexperienced at this level. Golovkin is not. He knows how to hurt you. You don't know how to deal with something like that.
And there were a lot of people, Victor. Yeah, at 21. And there were a lot of people, Victor, in the Twitterverse that were, talking about what if Jamie doesn't get knocked out in the first or second or even third round, but takes a sustained beating over, 10 or 11 rounds before Golovkin put them away. Or if Golovkin's job is to carry Jamie, to get some rounds in or to make, whatever. We all know how the politics of boxing play out, so I won't go into that. But for whatever reason, Golovkin decides to carry this guy. You know what I mean? Delivers this killer beating. And then the guy's career is over, you know what I mean?
If you're carrying someone, you're not really delivering that kind of beating, because that's opposite of what you're trying to do.
Right.
But yeah.
But those punches, those pity-pat punches, still, when there's enough of them, like they always say with Usyk, going back to that for a second, he's not the heaviest hitter, but, those taps, those love taps over 12 rounds add up. You know what I mean? They hurt. They do damage. So, that was my main point of contention with Munguia, or however you say his name, being a replacement for Canelo. Now I understood the whole, we want to replace a Mexican with another Mexican fighter because it's Cinco de Mayo, blah, 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 whatever. But I tweeted out, I don't know whether or not you saw it, but I said, shame on Tom Loeffler, shame on Gennady, shame on Abel, shame on any network that picks this up, or HBO, shame on everybody involved for being an enabler. The whole thing was wrong. It was bad. But again, the Nevada Athletic State Commission rejected him as an opponent for Golovkin just a couple of days ago or a few days ago. Now I'm seeing again that the front runner, at least publicly, is Gary or Spike O'Sullivan, as he's more commonly known. I don't know.
Gary.
Yeah, it is Gary from what That's I saw. I thought his first name was Spike. Yeah, I've always known him as Spike, but you know, and his beard or his mustache.
Yeah, like Spike isn't a very common name, so it does make more sense that it's actually Gary right. Spike is the nickname, as you know, Spike usually is. But shit, huh?
Right. Now that makes sense, Victor. But let me ask you: does a fight with Golovkin make sense given the the nature of they're looking for an opponent on 3 to 5 weeks' notice? You know, Canelo pulled out, all this horseshit mm-hmm. going on around the fight. Does Spike make more sense than someone like Jamie?
Obviously, I mean. Jamie shouldn't even be like they should not even allow that fight to happen
for right. Spike. And they didn't.
Say that, well, yeah, for Spike can at least say, all right, this guy's a middleweight. All right, this guy did just beat Antoine Douglas up pretty fucking badly. Who was he's not like elite. He's not top tier or anything like that. But people were
pretty high
on Antoine Douglas at one point before the
right.
before the Cassidy loss. So yeah, this is an okay fight as a replacement. It is still. You have to understand, we don't have a lot of options here anyway. Saunders is injured.
Right.
He's not going to fight again until June. You got I guess your only option is really like Andrade and Jeremy Pinchenko, because Jacobs also
right.
has an opponent. Charlotte has an opponent. Like, everyone is tied up right now.
Right. Now, here's the thing, Victor. Shortly before we went on the air today, while I was doing show prep, I always have Twitter open on my phone or on whatever computer I'm working on. And the first person I saw it from, just to give them credit, was Raging Babe, Michelle. She tweeted out that there was talk or whispers of the fight leaving Vegas and coming out here to Southern California and going over to the StubHub Center in Los Angeles. I went right to a couple of my sources and asked, have you guys heard anything about this? And every single one of them, I went to three of my top sources, said, what are you talking about? Like, who said this? So I told them, and they said, let me make some phone calls, let me write some emails, yada, yada, yada. And I only heard back from one of them before it was time for us to come on the air. And apparently there's some truth to it. I don't know how much, and they didn't know how much. I got to ask you, and then I'll chime in. How do you feel about the fight leaving Vegas? Given the nature of this, all the fuckery that's happened with this, with the rematch that fell through, how do you feel about it coming out here to where I'm at and someone like Spike and maybe being taken off pay-per-view? Do you think that's a good move or how do you feel?
Golovkin doesn't want this fight in Vegas. He doesn't want to do anything with Vegas. I can tell you that's from the way Vegas has been acting towards him. Like, he doesn't want
sure.
any part of this bullshit. And there. The paper, if they put anything on pay-per-view right now with Golovkin, it's not going to do well, because there's not an opponent there to make this fight do well. So it's always going to do poorly. This fight should just be on regular HBO.
Right.
It's a good move to not have them fight at Vegas, because I don't want to fight in Vegas if I'm Golovkin.
Well, and I agree with you, man. But when Canelo officially pulled out, and we all kind of thought he might at some point or would be forced out, I kept asking myself, okay, it's Gennady Golovkin, he's the middleweight champion of the world, you know what I mean? But it was one of those things where there's so much business tied up and a lot of powerful people and a lot of money, surrounding that venue and that city and even Golovkin minus Canelo, I thought there's no way they can, it doesn't belong in Vegas. It doesn't belong on pay-per-view without Canelo. But I just thought there's no way Golovkin's not a draw unless he's got the right partner. You know what I mean?
No, Golovkin's a draw. He's just not it's not at a thing where you can pay-per-view numbers already are going pretty fucking down. Like, this
is not
working out that way. There's only a few guys can carry a pay-per-view right now, and Golovkin isn't he's a big name, but he's not I'll carry this entire thing and get 500,000 buys or whatever. That's not going to happen right now.
Right. Yeah. It's one of the things I thought, man, you need to you need to, without Canelo in the mix, this fight needs to be downgraded a bit. You know what I mean? And be moving, or be moved over to regular HBO. I don't know that that's going to happen. I haven't heard anything about it coming off of pay-per-view. I don't even know that it can, logistically at this point. I just wonder how well it will sell. Guys like us, we'll pay to watch Gennady fight, but...
I'm still in my boxing protest.
Well, guys like us. I'm not going to pay for Golovkin versus I won't pay for Golovkin versus Canelo, no matter how they try to sell that.
Yeah.
Fuck of a mess when it comes back around in July and August when they start promoting that horse shit again. But like, and this is just all hypothetical, but I would pay to watch Golovkin fight like the top guys. You know what I mean? I don't want to see
that unification.
Yeah, yes, for the undisputed middleweight champion of the world. Yeah, I would shell out 50, 60, 70 bucks, or I'll go to the local bar that orders it. The one out of a million bars in this country that still airs pay-per-view boxing, which is a whole other show in of itself. But we'll have to do that when it's a slow boxing week. We can talk about all that bullshit. But
we might have time later on today, actually. I mean, you have an hour left.
We can let me mark that down. We can get into that later then, or even on another show if things, drag on as they sometimes do. But I'm hoping that it comes to Los Angeles. I only wish that it would have done so sooner, because I could have saved money, and made the trek to the StubHub to watch Golovkin. I would love to watch Golovkin before he retires. You know, that's one of those fighters that's kind of like on my boxing bucket list type of thing. Fighters I wish I could see live. But I don't know, man. I think Spike O'Sullivan would be an okay opponent. Definitely much better than Jamie Munguia. At least Spike's lost to, guys like Billy Joe and a couple other guys, I think. But at least he's fought on that world level. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
he's not a prospect. He's kind of a fringe contender, I guess, for lack of a better term, or even a high level gatekeeper. But if I want to go down that road, but I don't know. I guess we have to wait and see. I think they said Golovkin was going to have an announcement at some point in the near future. I don't know when exactly that's going to happen. I haven't heard anything. I've asked, and it's kind of fallen on deaf ears because the people that usually know don't know much. So I guess we have to wait and see.
I feel like nobody actually knows what's happening with this situation at all.
Yeah. There's a lot of, I hate to use the word secrecy, but I guess it would be better to say Tom Loeffler, Golovkin, everybody involved in this fight, you're right, is keeping everything close to their chest, Victor. There isn't a lot of information leaking out, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like you said, it's very, very secretive. And for me, even if they're moving it to the StubHub Center, Let's make the announcement. I kind of feel like, well, you have what? My birthday is 3 weeks from today, and the 5th is the weekend after my birthday. So it's like, let's get the fucking show on the road here, guys. You know what I mean? What are you waiting for? You know what I mean? I know that there's a lot of rushed business or hurried business in the works on Loeffler's side of things and on Gennady's side of things and probably on HBO's side of things as well and whomever his opponent might be on their side as well. But like this is a big deal. This is a Golovkin fight, and they're trying to salvage it. And there's a lot of eyes on what's going on. I don't understand, and maybe because I'm not a boxing insider, maybe I don't work in the business of boxing. I don't know what's going on. But for me, it's like shit or get off the pot here, guys. Let's tell people who have money tied up in flights and hotel rooms, and
exactly.
who have taking time off of work or taking mm-hmm. time away from their family to make a trip to Vegas, or even if people want to make the trip, for me it's no big deal. I can drive an hour and a half to the StubHub Center and I'm there and back home same day, no worries. But other people that have to drive or fly, or rearrange their plans, they don't want to find out 2 or 3 weeks before they fight. They want to find out now, so who knows what's going on over there in that neck of the woods, Victor? But I hope we get some answers and some announcements sooner rather than later for everybody involved. Now, was there anything else you wanted to add to that whole kind of Golovkin Canelo clusterfuck? Is the best word I can think of. That whole thing is a big giant mess. Go for it.
But first, let me ask you something. Have you seen Tom Loeffler really promote this a whole lot? Like anything regarding this, like as soon as Canelo tested positive, or even like a little bit before then, have you seen him promoting this a whole lot?
Dude, you did it again. I'm so glad you asked that question. Like that came out of left field. I was totally unprepared. And it's a good question. You're right. I hadn't really noticed or taken notice until you just asked that question, that Loeffler has been uncharacteristically kind of silent.
A whole lot of silence here, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, he's a boxing promoter. He's a businessman. He's got a job to do. And you want things. You want to keep. You've got to keep things under wrap with negotiations until everybody. You know, until everything's signed on the dotted line. Everything's agreed upon. I get it. But yeah, you're right. Ever since that news broke of the positive tests,
it's pretty much all been Oscar, right?
Yeah. And the damage control, and that's a whole other thing we can go over too later on even in another show.
Yeah, uh-huh. I'm thinking that Loeffler, like on Golovkin's side of things, that they are not controlling anything at all. I'm thinking that you remember how like the Kovalev Ward 2 fight happened, the rematch? How like Ward's team was the one that was in control of everything. They were open about it. Like, we're going to control everything. I'm thinking that's what's happening here. I don't even think Golovkin has any say on who he's going to fight next. I think this is still like in contract with the Canelo thing. And that would explain why we see like this out of character, like, I want to fight Jamie Moon. I can't say his name. But like, that would make sense if it's like an Oscar thing. Because none of this seems like Golovkin to me. None of it.
Well, you know, and that's true. And there, just to play devil's advocate here, Victor, I agree with you on that. And I don't even know if the logistics of something like that are possible.
Yeah, same.
But I've never heard. Doesn't mean it hasn't happened. But I've never heard in the 33 or 34 years that I've been watching the sport and in love with the sport. I don't know that I've ever seen it publicly. Made known publicly that the promotional outfit that a cheating fighter or an allegedly cheating fighter, is in charge of the initial promotion. If they retain control like that over the opponent, their guy's opponent, when their guy drops out or is forced to drop out or is suspended or whatever the case is, I don't know that's even allowed or illegal or what.
Yeah.
But I guess if you put it in a contract, Victor, that especially, I mean, boxing is a dirty, dirty business. We know that. So I won't go into that too much here. But given the dirty nature and the corrupt nature of the sport and some of the power, the power brokers that actually run and control everything, you know what I mean? Even above the promoter's level, I can see something like that happening. That was a really good question. I'll have to ask on that, and I'll make notes, and we'll talk about it more on a future show. But man, that's kind of fascinating to me, and that's I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility because
it's
said
like the
earlier,
only thing
in
the, makes sense, right? Like when you think about it, it's the only thing that makes sense.
It makes sense from not only Golovkin's viewpoint where, hey, him, Tom, and Abel, hey, well, we know we're confident we can beat anybody, but hey, you know, you're 36 years old now, Gennady. Maybe we want to take a less threatening opponent, you know what I mean? And if it would be all the big guys have shit lined up anyway, so he's not ducking anybody, you know what I mean? I would never say that about Golovkin, but maybe we take a lesser opponent and we preserve that, we make sure that payday in September is still there for us. We minimize risk this time, so that we can hook back up with Canelo Alvarez in the late summer, early fall, and make sure that happens for everybody. And I can see a scenario like you and I were just saying, where maybe the things that Golovkin and Loeffler and everybody signed in making this rematch give Golden Boy, Todd DeBuff and Oscar total control over who and where Gennady fights. I don't know, but I could definitely see that being a thing. That's a fascinating question, man. I'm gonna have to dig deep and ask some questions and go kind of sleuthing for a bit because I want to know if that's even possible. Now, I meant to ask you to kind of move the conversation along, Victor, with this whole thing, with this whole mess going on around Golovkin and this whole, failed rematch and this troubled promotion. It became very clear to me, and I kind of feared this when he first got involved with Canelo, but am I wrong or am I seeing things and hearing things? Are they visual and auditory hallucinations, or has Golovkin's career like almost completely stalled out?
Oh, definitely. They fucked things up a whole lot. I mean, if you think about it, Golovkin was trying to fight Saunders in June of last year, back when the Canelo and Chavez Jr. fight happened, they were like, oh, no, we're not going to let you do that because, you know, it might ruin the negotiations for our fight in September. Now, at that time, their fight wasn't announced, the Golovkin and Canelo fight, and I thought Golovkin was just being stupid to just abide by these rules. But the way that happened tells me that that fight was already just signed and decided upon before Chavez Jr. fight even happened. So, yeah, they were definitely stalling him out. They let him, they made it so that he couldn't get that unification fight that he wanted to be undisputed. They are now messing up his career where he can't take another fight right now. We just don't know what's happening. He can't stay busy like he wants to. So, yeah, they are definitely fucked up his shit.
Yeah. I don't necessarily put all the blame on Canelo / Golden Boy. I mean, Golovkin had to have known. I'm sure Abel did too, and Abel's kind of an advisor to him as well. I'm sure his brother knew. I'm sure Max knew, Tom Loeffler definitely knew. Yeah, it was like, well, but I would put money on. I wish I could have been a fly on the wall in the months or a couple of years leading up to that, you know, the negotiations of that first fight, because it was kind of like, well, Gennady probably thought, well, I can beat this guy. You know what I mean? I'm sure he looked at Canelo and thought, well, I got this. I'll handle this guy. And then, you know, because I'm sure Tom said or Abel said or somebody said, you know, Gennady, if we do this, you might get tied up with this guy for years, you know, in rematches, in disputes, and all this other horse shit that's basically come to fruition. And now Golovkin is stuck, even though the guy, if what you said or the question you asked me turns out to be true, Victor, he's stuck with another promotional entity telling him how and who or how, when and where and whom he can and can't fight. So, I mean, you know, it's kind of like you go to work for the devil, so to speak. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're not even involved with the guy you wanted to fight anymore. And it's possible, and I would even go so far as to say probable, that another promoter is controlling your destiny and your paydays. You know what I mean? And your, by that extent, your legacy. So, but yeah, I wanted to get somebody else's opinion on how they felt about Golovkin's career, because he's still like my number one guy. Like I get, you know, my blood pumps and I get excited as soon as I know he's got a fight. And when I hear Seven Nation Army kicking over the PA system, you know, it's like, oh my God, I'm fucking pumped. You know what I mean? Like I'm ready. But like I would never deny that since getting involved with Canelo, like, especially after the first fight and all the bullshit that went on with that, like there's some of the steam has come off my fandom for Golovkin. Like, I'm no longer a fan of Canelo. That's been washed, because I believe, I don't know, but I do believe that he's guilty of using performance enhancing drugs.
How long did your fandom of Canelo even last? Was it like 2 months?
No. I was a fan of Canelo. I watched him on, this was years ago. I watched him on the Spanish HBO broadcast. I don't remember who he was fighting.
Because I remember, like, we were talking at one point, you were saying, like, Canelo isn't really that impressive to you. So I felt like you weren't really, like, that big of a fan of his.
No, I liked Canelo. I mean, I was always aware of the hype surrounding him, and that he's another one of those fighters that's not really what, you know, we're told he is or what he's supposed to be. And now, given, you know, all the allegations surrounding him, I'm more inclined to believe that than ever. But and I still ask myself, what outside of, you know, going the distance with Golovkin, what has he really done? You know what I mean? That's of special note. But yeah, I mean, I'm not a fan. I was never a fan of Canelo like I have been of Golovkin, or like I was of Tyson or Hagler or any of those, or even Leonard or any of those, you know, those guys. But it was, Canelo was always one of those guys that, hey, Canelo's on. Okay, yeah, I'll make sure I sit down and watch it live. You know what I mean?
Okay.
He always had my attention. I wasn't busting out the, you know, I've got my Golovkin shirt on every time we do this show, or one of them. You know what I mean? It wasn't like I got to rush out and buy the cardboard cutout of Canelo to put in my office, you know, or hang on, you know, one of his fight posters on my wall. It was never like that. But it was like, yeah, you know, I like Canelo. Yeah, I'll go to watch him fight. Or, hey, you know, I'll make sure I'm home when he's fighting so I can watch it live, you know. And, you know, I wanted to see him push the envelope and be tested. And we saw what happened when that finally happened. But, yeah, man, I don't know. I'm still a big fan of Golovkin. He's still my favorite guy to watch, and I look forward to his fights. But that steam that he had moving forward, guy was fighting 3 or 4 times a year, and I know he had the death of his father stalled him out, and then he had a problem the year before after that where it was only he only fought 2 or 3 times. You know, shit. I don't give guys shit when that things like that happen because it happens to all of us. You know, we have to take time off, but. I don't know. I'm not as excited to see Golovkin fight this time as I was even when I went to watch him fight Canelo, you know, when I went down to the movie theater to watch the pay-per-view, you know, in any fight before that. I kind of feel my level of excitement just not a little more than slightly, just dipping down a little bit as time goes on because it's like I look at him and it's like, okay, now you fight twice a year, which is one of the things I hate most about the sport. Because you know they always what do they always say? Oh, they use the excuse of well, it takes 6 months to do a properly promote this fight. No, it doesn't. You've got and I know other people in the media agree with me. I've heard them say it on their own shows. You've got two of the biggest names in the sport. You can promote this shit in 2 or 3 months if you really wanted to, and if the fighters really wanted to. And I'm glad. Thank you. I'm glad you agree with me because we've seen it happen before. It occasionally happens. You know. If people are interested in the two fighters and there's good drama there, there's some intrigue there, people are going to watch. People are going to buy. You know what I mean? Good matchmaking overrides everything most of the time.
Yeah, that whole, like, it's going to take 6 months to promote this, that was bullshit. They were just waiting on Golovkin to get older because if they really felt that way that they needed that much time to promote this, they would have a good undercard on the first fight, but they didn't. So the fact that they didn't show us is they know that these two can, like, carry the event themselves. And if you have that where two guys can carry the event themselves, you know that they don't need 6 months for you to carry it yourself. You're the promoter. You don't need 6 months. You know you don't need 6 months.
Well, look at and a good example of that, it's both good and bad, is the Pacquiao Mayweather fight. You know, that promotion was so shitty and so quiet and so brief, but it's still like the highest grossing pay-per-view or like watch fight, you know what I mean? And it was, I mean, regardless of what the outcome of that fight. Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, when you work in customer service now, and I was a customer service rep, manager, supervisor, and executive at one point in my life, and this was like spanning 15 years. And something I'm sure you've heard, you know, in your job, and I heard, and I told people all the time, this product sells itself, you know what I mean? Or they tell me, well, your company's product sold itself. Nobody really told me I needed it. It was just so awesome, I picked it up, and now here I am on the phone with you. You know what I mean? It's one of those things, and you're right. A good product, a good restaurant, good food, anything quality sells itself most of the time. Sometimes, you know, things go awry and don't do as well as they should, you know, or could, but most of the time that's not the case. But yeah, man, I don't know. I think Golovkin is, I'm sure he would disagree with me if he were to call into the show or I were to talk to him in person. I'm sure he's very happy with the paydays that he's going to, you know, that he got from Canelo and that he'll get either in the fall or next May. But I think he's hurt his career and by that, you know, to that extent, his legacy to a large degree by even getting involved with Canelo. I hate to see that. I knew it when he signed on to fight Canelo that it was going to be, he was turning into that, you know, he was going to follow that Mayweather or Canelo or Eric Gomez business plan where you fight twice a year and you don't do much else in between. So, you know, I guess it is what it is. It's boxing and, you know, Golovkin will be here for as long as he's here, and after that, hopefully there'll be somebody else to take his, you know, that mantle up of that guy you got to see 3 or 4 times a year. But you never know. I guess we have to wait and see on that one as well. Was there anything else you wanted to add to that, man?
Well, you actually reminded me of something. You mentioned Mayweather at one point beyond the Mayweather and Pacquiao comparison, but Mayweather's team was actually shot at recently. His bodyguard was hit.
I saw that.
Suspected drive-by. Yeah.
Yeah, I saw that. What the hell is going on there? I saw it actually right before. I wasn't going to comment on it today because I didn't have enough time to read the articles and stuff. I was, you know, doing my prep and getting ready to come on the air with you to do our pre-show kind of powwow. And I saw that and I thought, what the fuck is this all about? What's going on? And the only thing that I got out of it before I called into the show and got connected was that the authorities weren't sure if his bodyguard was actually the target of the shooting or if he was just, you know, an unlucky you know, an unlucky victim, I guess.
It's very rare that a bodyguard would be the fucking target of anything like this, so I'm pretty sure he was just the unlucky victim.
Yeah, do you think they were targeting Mayweather?
Shit, maybe. I mean, we don't know who else was in there, but who knows, man.
Jesus Christ, man. This fucking world we live in, I tell you what, dude. Ugh. Drives me nuts. Yeah, I don't want to see anybody get shot. But, yeah, outside of that, man, there's just a couple of news and notes we have left here. The next one down on the list, Victor, was we had mentioned Adelaide Bird earlier in the fight. She worked the Alfredo Angulo Sergio Mora fight, which didn't need to happen, period. But she turned in.
I didn't see
yet
that one. Who won?
Mora did, and it was kind of disputed because I don't really remember. I didn't have time to put the scores down. I just remember getting word that she had turned in an odd scorecard. I guess odd is kind of a generous word given who's involved. But I'll say this:
scores.
Yeah.
She's probably the 74-78 person.
Yeah, if you have any doubts about corruption in boxing being a real thing, I mean, look at Adelaide Bird, people. You know what I mean? And you already know this, Victor, so I'm preaching to the choir with you, but anybody that might be listening to the show live or, you know, archived, this is all the evidence you need to know that this sport is not entirely corrupt, but has some really bad problems with judges, with referees, and sometimes with fighters as well. I mean, Adelaide Bird was instrumental. She wasn't the only piece of the puzzle, but she was instrumental in fucking Golovkin over in his first fight with Canelo back on September 9th or whatever date that was. Might have been the week after. I don't remember. And it pissed everybody off. It tainted the fight. It made Canelo look bad. It made Golden Boy look bad. And to some extent, it made Golovkin and Tom Lawler look bad because a lot of people thought everybody was in on it. You know what I mean? And this was, hey, we're just setting this up we're setting the rematch up automatically here. Thanks for paying for the commercial, you know what I mean, type of thing. But, yeah, I mean, Adelaide Bird was, you know, and Mike Montero from Montero and Boxing pushed Bob Bennett, the head of the Nevada Athletic State Commission, in the post presser at that fight, and said, you know, what's going to be done about this? Is anything going to be, you know, is anybody going to investigate Adelaide Bird? And Bob just kind of shooed Mike away and wanted somebody to take the microphone away from the guy for asking a really good question. And then, as we know, nothing happened to Adelaide Bird. She went right back to work not long after that fight. Yeah, and it's like this. This is like Teddy. Everybody gets mad at Teddy Atlas. Oh, he's on his rant. Corruption or incompetence. You agree, whether you like Teddy or not, whether you like his behavior or not, you cannot deny that it's one or the other in this fucking sport. And this, I mean, Adelaide Bird
That's
is a prime
took his
example.
Ass off of ESPN.
Yeah, exactly. Adelaide Bird is a prime example of corruption in boxing. I mean, all that shit she did before Canelo and Golovkin won was brushed under the rug, or people looked the other way. You know, why people like you and I are screaming on our shows and on Twitter, you know, do something, make the sport fair, you know, make sure everything's on the up and up. And then she goes right back to work again and again and again. And then she continually turns in these fucked up scorecards, yet nothing happens. I mean, she's not even fucking suspended. You know what I mean? So
exactly.
This, you know, to all those
no
people.
Which is the
no,
worst
you're,
thing about
you're right.
It.
You're right. But this is, I wanted to bring this up today, Victor, because I take a lot of shit. Well, you don't know, it's not corruption. It's people aren't bad people. Yes, there's a lot of shitty people walking this planet. There's a lot of people that put money and favor and position before anything else. And I know that's the nature of I won't say business, just life itself. Unfortunately, you know, it's one of those evils that you're never going to get away from 100% or even 50%. In boxing, I mean, it's a real thing. Don't tell me that corruption isn't happening. Don't tell me that inside and outside interests don't have money in the sport to make sure certain things happen or don't happen with certain fighters, with certain fights, with certain promotions, with certain locations or promoters. It's fucking dirty. And if you go read anything on the history of boxing and corruption, You know what I mean? All the way, you'll find organized crime involved. You'll find promoters involved. You'll find collusion between fighters. You'll find all kinds of crazy shit. You know, it doesn't always happen all the time, but it happens. So, yeah. So don't tell me that corruption isn't real or that it's not happening in boxing. I can't stand that. That fucking, to me, when people tell me, Victor, that corruption isn't real, or that you guys like you and I are seeing things, or that the you know, certain reporters or journalists that report on it, or just, you know, they're delusional or not seeing the bigger picture, those people are fucking deluded, or they're full of shit, or they're in on the fix as well, because this shit happens, and it happens too often. But let's move on, and I wanted to talk about something that happened after the Laura Hurd fight that didn't air on Showtime, but Showtime tweeted it out. It was a video, Victor, of Kell Brook confronting Errol Spence, a very friendly confrontation where they shook hands and agreed to a matchup at some point in the future. I wanted to get your thoughts on a potential Brooks-Spence matchup before I chime in with my own. So I'll let you have the mic and go at it.
I like it. I'm not mad at that matchup. I think if they fight at 154 and Spence is expected to go back down to 147 and defend his title, that Brook wins. If Spence vacates his belt, or if he loses in between the time and he doesn't have a belt anymore and he goes up to 154 and fights Brook, then I consider it about a 50-50. It's kind of... I don't know how to feel about Brook, because he has two bad injuries and he's fighting right now, two career-ending injuries, if you think about it. The orbital bone breaks, and I don't know if that's the sort of thing that can actually be fixed, or if he's still, like, damaged because of that, you know? I don't know if he's, like,
sure, has
a high chance of that happening again or what. So I really don't know, but I'm not mad at that matchup.
You know, it's not the worst matchup, I guess. I guess part of me says, you know what, dude, relax. Be thankful he's not fighting, you know, like Andre Berto or somebody on that level. You know what I mean? Given the nature of how they're moving him and things over on that side of the fence the last few years have gone. But my concern with the fight is – or my questions about the fight is, how much does Brook have left? I think Golovkin ruined him to some degree, and then when he got his other orbital bone broken in the fight after that, it's just one of those things where how much does Spence have left? How much does Brook have left? You know what I mean? And how credible a threat is he to Errol Spence at this stage of the game? I think before Golovkin, I would have jumped all over that fight or potential fight. You know, I would be telling you right now, I got to see this, because I thought Kell Brook was very, very good at his best. But I don't think he is at his best anymore. And I don't think the Golovkin fight and the fight after did him any favors, you know, health or psychologically speaking, I should say. But I don't know that we actually get it next. But
we shouldn't.
Yeah, I'm trying to think off the top of my head who they could or might put Spence in with in lieu of a Brook fight. I know that, and there's always a part of me, even though I know it's completely unrealistic to expect it, I can't get over wanting Spence and Crawford to fight. Even if they do, it's years away. But it's so hard for me to get over that, because it's like right now would be the best time for that to happen. But you know, from a physical standpoint. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, who else besides Brook could you see them putting him in with?
Jesse Vargas.
Vargas.
Wait, doesn't
Vargas
he have a
wins?
Fight?
Yeah, I was gonna say if Vargas wins.
Yeah, who does he fight next?
I had it on my notes, and I've got to go back and find it.
You look this up on Boxer.
Yeah, we're not just for our listeners. We're not actually this ill-informed.
Broner, that's right.
Victor and I
now.
Tend to forget things. Yeah.
Wait.
Yeah. I'm actually. Yeah, I'm actually picking Vargas in that fight.
Same.
Broner's just. Broner had some talent, and Broner's one of those underachievers. I don't think he would have ever been elite level, per se, but I think he would have been somebody.
Is he an underachiever? If you think about it, he's an overachiever. I'm the four-weight division champion. That's overachieving.
Let's go into fantasy land for just a minute here. Let's imagine for a second that Adrian Broner starts his career not with Al Heyman or the PBC, but with a really good promoter, let's say a more proven promoter, I guess, a more competent promoter, with a Golden Boy, with Tom Loeffler, with Top Rank, one of the big three there, and they matched him tough, and they had a mentor. Let's say he had a mentor with him the whole time and kept him straight as an arrow. Given what we know, the skill set that he had at one time, where would his ceiling have been under the right promoter and with somebody to rein him in?
Not very high. He would have lost. He's not that good. He was never that good. He was only good when he was a weight bully. He was just, a weight bully. That's the only time.
Yeah. He definitely did his best work. What was that, at 130 that he came in? Mm-hmm. He came in at? And he's moved up. As he's moved up, he's become far less effective. I look at a guy like Broner that, I don't think he was great either, but the majority of his problems, at least from my perspective, come from an inability to control his behavior outside of the ring. He, you know what I mean? Or maybe he just doesn't care. Maybe it's a psychological thing. I don't know. You know, maybe one of those things where
his behavior outside the ring actually helps him. It makes people like care about him, like, oh yeah, Broner, whatever the fuck, and they like care about his matches because of that. If you take away his little antics outside of that, there's no reason to even watch him. So that would be even worse for him. Just, he's not very good. Overachiever is what he is.
I said underachiever initially because I always wonder when I see troubled guys like that or you know, athletes with problems outside of their sport, where I think, man, what could this guy have done with the right people around him and the right promoters that were doing good business, you know what I mean? I think Broner may have probably would have definitely fizzled out. You know, I think his talents would only take him so far. But I think had he stayed at 130 or 135 and had the right people around him and stuff, I think he would have done a little bit better than he's done. I can see how you could say he's an overachiever. But I would come back at you with, well, just to play devil's advocate, you know, he has for an overachiever, he has the quote unquote right promoter and the right people around him, because not only do they enable him, you know what I mean, to do what he does outside the ring, so people go, I want to watch this clown fight, you know, or at least it's funny to watch him fail, you know what I mean? Like when he fought Madonna, that was one of the funniest boxing matches I've ever fucking seen in my life. Like, I laughed so hard at every aspect of that fight, but like, these people enable him, and the matchmaking, they stick Broner in with guys that they know he's going to beat. Broner's never been pushed.
And he still fucking loses.
Yeah. See, now I wonder, is he losing because of his bullshit outside of the ring, his inability to control himself, or his unwillingness to control himself, or is it just his talent level is, he's just hit that ceiling, regardless of what he does in or out of the
ring? He's not very good. I'll tell you that. He's not very good.
Okay. So to jump back over to Vargas for a second, you think if Vargas wins, they'll throw him in there?
Yeah, probably. You know who I do consider an underachiever, though?
Who?
Demetrius Andrade, or Andrade, or however.
Really? See, I was never – I think he likes to be called Andrade.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We all called him Andrade because of Labrado Andrade, and he said, no, I'm Andrade, or Andrade. Okay. Go for it.
Oh, yeah. Now, I consider him an underachiever because when you look at his talent level, you're like, all right, this guy could be a champion at some point. And then all the promotional problems, you haven't really seen him in a fight against anybody decent at all, ever. I guess his best opponent is what? Shit, who would his best opponent be?
I don't know. That's a good question.
Maybe he fought Brian Rose. Oh, whatever. Point is, though, that goes on with my point, though. Underachiever in his case, because you're like, all right, this guy has a lot of talent, and you have nothing to show for it in his case.
Yeah. Yeah, I was never...
Marta Rosian. That's who I was thinking of.
Yeah, okay, Von and Smart Erosion. Yeah, I would agree with that. I was never there's obviously talent there. Let me preface this with talent or with this. Demetrius Andre definitely has talent. I'm not going to take that guy away from that guy or claim that he's mediocre or anything. I think to some degree it's fair to call him an underachiever, but at the same time, given who he's associated with, I can't help but put that back on his own shoulders. You know what I mean? I mean, these guys sign the contracts and stick it out. You know what I mean? And I always wondered, and it's probably going to be the case long after he's gone from the sport, Victor. I don't think an Andre is ever going to be in there with someone like Golovkin or anyone on that level. He's one of those guys that's tough to negotiate with, doesn't fight very often, you know, which means he doesn't get to hone his skills, you know what I mean, and his talents. I definitely think he has a much higher ceiling than what we've seen or where he's at now. But so from that aspect, I think it's kind of a shame that he's, you know, promoted by the PBC or by Heyman. But I don't know. I never thought Andrade was going to be the next big thing in any division he was a part of, but he's definitely good, and I definitely think he could be much better. I don't know. He called out. He said he wanted to be Canelo's replacement. Given his past, I kind of, you know, in his track record, I kind of questioned, and so did a lot of other people. I kind of questioned where, you know, how honest he was being in that. You know,
no, it's not. Andrade has always tried to get fights. It's just that his promotional team kind of fucked him over there with the whole dual promotions thing, and he gets avoided. So it's not like he's avoiding other guys. He's being avoided, and he just also can't fight at times. So I don't think he's just, like, saying that for the sake of saying it. I think he legitimately wanted that fight. It's just that it's not going to happen.
Not going to happen, yeah. Yeah, I don't know, man. And sadly, things like this are the norm in boxing. It's. I mean, it gives us things to talk about on a show, but or to tweet about. But I wish the sport moved a little quicker and a little smoother, just so that we got, you know, the fights we wanted, and we could see what guys like Andre are really made of. You know what I mean? Because like you said it many times, and so have I, both on the show and online. You can't really hone your skills or become sharp or stay in top shape when you fight once a year or twice a year or, you know, once every 2 years, as some of these guys over on that side of the fence do. And even some top ranked guys. I mean, God, Crawford frustrates the hell out of me. He's largely inactive, and he was until he vacated, he was the undisputed light welterweight champion of the world. So it's like, you know, fuck, let shit or get off the pot here, guys. You know, and going back to the World Boxing Super Series tournament, especially the 200-pound tournament, I mean, that thing has come off, and if we're probably fortunate in some regards that there's been no injuries and whatnot, but that thing was put together so well that, you know, none of that diva bullshit has been allowed to creep in. You know, these fights come off without a hitch, and they've all been exciting at 200. So I wish we got more of that than what we got with what we're getting now in most other, you know, corners of the sport. So I don't know, man. Did you have anything other to add, or did you want to wrap it up early today?
We can wrap it up for now. We can get something to
all
eat.
Right. Yeah, my hypoglycemia is really fucking me up. I'm starting to get like numb in my neck, which is the first sign that I'm getting.
Man.
Yeah, I don't always take the greatest care of myself, and it gets worse as I get older. So we'll just call it a day then. Victor and I will be back next week to review and preview this weekend's action, which there isn't a ton of, nor is it overly exciting or important, but we'll be back to do that. This has been episode 19 of the Loaded Gloves Boxing Podcast. Again, if you have questions or comments, you can reach me on Twitter at SplitTheBoxing or Victor at 757Vic. You can also like us on Facebook at facebook.com/SplitTheBoxing. You can follow us on Twitter, as I just said. You can visit the revamped SplitTheBoxing.com website. And if you are so inclined to do so, you can give us all of your money on patreon.com/SplitTheBoxing. So for myself, Scott Jarvis, and my co-host Victor Atkinson, this has been episode 19 again, and we'll see you next week. Thanks for listening.
Who's gonna bust your chops now?
Chops now! I couldn't help myself, man.